Indie Comics. Indie Comics.
Welcome to this episode of ORP, where we discuss comics, writing, and the pop culture that fascinates us. For today, we're turning our attention back to the Marvel Universe, this time to one of my favorite mid-tier characters, and that would be Moon Knight, the Fist of Khonshu. Since the character is so complex, this is going to be a two-part episode, with this episode focusing on Moon Knight's comic appearances. But before we get into what makes Moon Knight fascinating, did you have any thoughts you wanted to start us off with, Mike? Did you have any history with Mark Spector, or was he someone you discovered more recently?
It is definitely more of a recent discovery for me. I heard a lot of talk about Moon Knight, though a lot of it was just saying that he was a Batman ripoff. And I'll be honest and say that that perception of the character from those who had read the comic really steered me away from reading it. I had no interest in Marvel's Batman, but we will discuss that in more detail shortly. However, I did want to check out the Moon Knight series on Disney Plus, and it quickly became one of my favorite shows in the MCU. Then this episode came up, and I did a deep dive into several of the Moon Knight trades that are available on Comixology, and my whole perception of the character vastly changed, and he has moved up to being one of my favorite characters from Marvel. But what about you, Steve? When did you get into Moon Knight?
Believe it or not, I'll admit that Moon Knight was a character that didn't really hit my radar until he joined the West Coast Avengers way back in the day. I mean, don't get me wrong, he always had this really cool visual design, and I remember some of the old Marvel House ads from the 80s featuring him that were really cool, and those ads were drawn by the great Bill Sienkiewicz, so they left an impact. But it was those WCAA issues that really got me thinking about how cool the idea of Moon Knight is. So here you have this urban vigilante who was a mercenary, and then he died, and he was resurrected by an Egyptian god. And ever since, he's been wearing these Egyptian-style weapons as he conducts this Batman-style mission. That always appealed to me as a fan of pulp adventure heroes like Indiana Jones and Doc Savage. All of this was before his muddled identities evolved into a full-blown case of dissociative identity disorder, which I'm sure we'll discuss in more depth soon enough. But in any case, this is a character that I had ideas for since a long time, and he was one of the first characters who really got my writer's brain firing, because Moon Knight really has a lot of layers that you can explore, both in terms of his background and as a character. You can do urban crime stories, high adventure stories, war stories, cosmic mystical stories, or even explore bizarre psychodramas. There are a lot of different ways you can go with Moon Knight, and that's probably why you get many runs that do these weird and experimental takes with him.
You know, layers is right. Not only are there different aspects of Khonshu, there are different aspects of Mark Spector. I have noticed in my reading that each writer comes in leaning into one aspect or another of Mark or Khonshu, or both, to tell their stories. But then there are writers like Brian Michael Bendis that make it so that Mark starts to pick up alternate personalities that he acquired from interacting with Spider-Man, Wolverine, and Captain America, a story that leans very heavily into Mark's DID. But I'm getting a bit ahead of myself here, and I believe you had a pretty big point that needs to be discussed here, don't you, Steve?
That was a really weird moment that you brought up, but yes, let's get into the big point. Before we really dive into the comics runs, I feel like we need to first address the elephant in the room. There's no question that Moon Knight draws some influence from Batman. While I don't think Doug Mensch, his creator, was directly thinking about Batman when he created Moon Knight, it's well known that Mensch is a huge fan of Batman. In fact, Doug Mensch did a lengthy run on Batman in the 90s under Denny O'Neill. So it's more likely that the unintentional influence of Batman crept in over time, especially as Moon Knight evolved from a mercenary into an anti-hero. But I think Moon Knight is a case where the character has grown into very much his own character, rather than simply being Marvel's Batman. Some of that comes from the unique elements that Mensch weaved into Moon Knight, like the Egyptian origin, the resurrection angle, the mercenary backstory, and the DID, although the DID angle was mainly the work of other writers building on what Mensch had set up. Also, Moon Knight crosses lines that Batman won't touch. You want a Batman who kills people and goes into edgy and grimdark territory? That's Moon Knight. You want a Batman who really is insane rather than one who's controlled by a personal code and an unwavering vow to his parents? That's Moon Knight. This is honestly what gets me a little, but people who want Batman to be more bloodthirsty, we already have that guy out there, and that's Mark Spector. You kind of tread on Moon Knight's territory when Batman is leaning that way as well, and that makes them both less unique. But that's getting off tangent. Mike, did you have any thoughts about the Batman-Moon Knight connection?
I definitely do, Steve, but something just occurred to me that I had not thought of before. Do you think that Denny O'Neil actually had an influence in perhaps some of that Batman perception? Obviously Denny O'Neil's a big Batman guy.
Maybe indirectly, because Denny O'Neil had written that landmark 70s run before Doug Mensch took over the character, and that was around 1975, so it's possible.
As far as the Batman Moon Knight connection thing, in my personal opinion, now that I know a bit about the character, I can say that the similarities between Moon Knight and Batman are surface level only. To compare the two is like comparing Charles Manson to Ted Bundy, because they both killed people, were all over the media, and had a following. In truth, Manson and Bundy have almost nothing in common, save but a few surface level things. And I think that is the case here. Whatever similarities there were at one time, they certainly do not exist in any substantial level in the comics from the 2000s that I have read, aside from gadgetry and vehicles. To take it one step farther, I am not a fan of the Batman comparison, at least as far as calling him Marvel's Batman. That perception kept me from reading a great comic, and I know now that I have been missing out on Moon Knight. But what do you say we dive into the comic, Steve?
Let's do that. But before I do, I'll just add that I completely agree with all that. It's kind of like how flying powerhouses with capes get compared to Superman. I mean, the dark urban vigilante is an archetype that was defined by Batman, sure, but he wasn't even the first one to do it. He took inspiration from characters like the Shadow. Moon Knight is just building on the archetype in his own way. So let's get into how the comics developed him. So I'm going to throw out some surprises here. Batman was not a part of Moon Knight's initial conception in any way. That stuff came later. In fact, nobody even knew that Moon Knight would end up being a hero with his own book. The character started off as an enemy of the werewolf, Jack Russell, in the werewolf's own title. And yes, the name Jack Russell for a werewolf is hilarious. Moon Knight was designed to be a contrast to the werewolf, and he was very different from the Moon Knight we know today. So Moon Knight's first appearance was in Werewolf by Night, number 32, in 1975. However, he did not debut as a hero, but more as an antagonist. The idea came from Doug Mensch, who was then writing the werewolf title and just looking for an interesting villain for Jack Russell.
You know, co-creator Don Perlin has added a little bit to that. Apparently, they were told that Werewolf by Night needed a costume character in the book, and that is also tied to the inspiration for the character as well. My guess is that they were told that they needed this costume character, and that kind of got the ball rolling.
That makes sense, and it's very likely that Perlin is right on that. They probably wanted a costume hero to bring more interest to the book. Anyway, the setup was handed to Mensch, with the werewolf having to deal with a criminal group called the Committee. Mensch wasn't particularly interested in the Committee themselves, but he did think that a mercenary villain working for them could make for a good conflict. Mensch's original idea was for a character that he called Moonblood, intended to be an anti-lycanthropic type of mercenary. Eventually, the Moonblood name was thrown out by editorial, thinking it was too similar to other 70s heroes like Ulysses Bloodstone. Now, personally, I think Moonblood sounds more 90s than 70s, but that's just me. In any case, Mensch had other possible names that he threw out, including Moon Knight, which is the name that eventually stuck.
You know, considering that Mark thought the name Moon Knight was stupid in the comics, I have to wonder if that was Mensch's least favorite of the names he came up with, at least initially. The character Mark Spector seems to have fully embraced the costume and the name given to him by the collective by the time we reach issue number 33, going so far as to tear the werewolf, he was going to send him a bill for tearing his cape. That's a far cry from taking the costume and name with such disdain in issue 32. I don't know. I just wonder how much of that character arc was Mensch coming to like the character more.
I can easily believe that happened. I mean, sometimes you start writing a character and you get more attached to him during the writing process. So that could very well have happened here. But Mensch felt that creating a good villain when the hero is literally a monster was complicated. As Doug Mensch explained it in an essay called Shades of Moon Knight, quote, "When your villain is a monster, your villains are often actually heroes. Either that or something even worse than the monstrous character of the series title. After all, who else would risk life and limb to battle werewolves, vampires, and zombies, unquote, aside from Buffy? as Bench intended it, the character that became Moon Knight would be more of a hero antagonist, so someone that only the werewolf would see as a villain. Much like the enemy of a criminal hero tends to be an officer of the law, the enemy of a werewolf would be a werewolf hunter. That led to the idea of a mercenary who was basically heroic, even if he had some darker edges to him. All of his design elements were built around Moon Knight as a werewolf hunter. The reason why Moon Knight wears white is because he is in fact wearing silver, the bane of werewolves. Some of his weapons would also be silver, like the spiked cestus he sometimes uses on his fists. The moon theme was included because the power of the werewolf comes from the moon, so the moon-themed villain made sense. Interesting fact, Doug Bench intended the moon symbol on his chest to be red, and werewolf artist Don Perlin persuaded him to change it to silver instead. The red was probably a holdover from the moon blood idea, and it made sense to ditch it when the moon name changed. Mench also changed other elements, like giving Moon Knight the ability to glide in his capes, one of his cool signature moves.
That is a cool move for sure. You know, Don Perlin had this to say about Moon Knight's costume creation. He said, "I wanted the costume to be just black and white, since he'd be on a color page. That would make him a little bit different," unquote. However, Mench said, "I have a costume that's just like the moon, just black and white, jet and silver, no color on the costume," unquote. So it seems like both men are kind of claiming the costume credit there. Do we once again have a situation where the Marvel method came back to bite the creators in the ass here, Steve?
It's very possible, as Marvel style was still in vogue during the 70s. But I honestly think Perlin was right on this one, especially after the character evolved away from the werewolf hunter concept. Silver and black is a lot simpler and more streamlined, and the red really isn't needed to make Moon Knight look creepy and cool. As a quick note, I'll mention where the name Mark Spector came from. He's actually based on a real person who was a friend of Doug Mench's. Apparently, the real Mark Spector would have asked jokingly to Mench, "When are you going to put me in a comic?" Mench seriously wanted to do that, liking the name, but he kept it in his head, looking for a spooky enough character to use it for. When he created Moon Knight, he decided that the name Mark Spector fit, and the rest is history. Anyway, the two-part werewolf story that introduced Moon Knight was successful, leading to other Moon Knight appearances after that. When the Hulk magazine title needed a backup strip, editor Ralph Macchio, no relation to the Karate Kid, pushed for Moon Knight because he was a huge fan of the character. That ended up leading to strong fan reaction, including even a fan base in Japan, where according to Doug Mench, there was a Moon Knight TV series. And I'll be honest, I want to see that. That led to Doug Mench taking over a monthly Moon Knight title in 1980, drawn by Bill Sienkiewicz. And by the end of that run, Moon Knight would eclipse the title that he was born from.
I could totally see that happening, especially but not limited to issue number 33. While this is not the version he would one day become, I feel like this particular version of Mark Spector really came into his own in that second appearance. But what do you say we get into the 1980 run, Steve?
Sounds good to me. After his first appearances in Werewolf by Night, I tend to ignore the stories leading up to Moon Knight's first ongoing series. Why, you may ask? Because Doug Mench himself did the minute he started up the ongoing series. He had decided that what worked for a mercenary werewolf hunter wouldn't work for Moon Knight as a hero and the star of his own title. To make that work, elements were changed, and Doug Mench retconned his own previous stories to account for the new approach. The main thing was explaining why Moon Knight fought the werewolf in the first place. Mench's solution is that Moon Knight was working undercover as a means of infiltrating the committee. So while he fought the werewolf because he saw a legitimate threat, Mark's real focus was in taking down the criminal organization. That is something that he ultimately does, and it is part of his MO. And it leads to a story where the details are cleared up. The committee tries to reform and gets revenge on Moon Knight, and that ultimately fails. Now, the first issue of Moon Knight details Mark's real origin, which is his origin moving forward. Half the story is a flashback to Mark's past as a mercenary, where he worked for a ruthless boss named Raoul Bushman. Mark was Bushman's second in command until he started having doubts, thinking that Bushman was going too far with his methods. When Bushman starts threatening an Egyptologist named Dr. Peter Alron, hoping to steal the gold that he discovered in a lost Egyptian tomb, it ends in Alron's murder. Mark decides that he's had enough. He takes a stand against Bushman, and Bushman eventually leaves him for dead in the desert. With his last breath, Mark reaches the lost tomb, falling at the statue of Khonshu, and then he miraculously refers from the dead. Mark becomes Moon Knight, wearing the shroud of Khonshu that he found in the temple, and he defeats Bushman. After this, Bushman becomes one of Mark's recurring arch enemies throughout the series.
Wow. I think it's important to note here that Raoul Bushman did not just kill Dr. Peter Allwrong. He did so in front of his daughter and colleague Maureen Allwrong. And that adds another level to Bushman's ruthlessness, in my opinion. What I don't know is where the heck was Mark's friend Jean-Paul Duchamp, a.k.a. Frenchie? I mean, is he even mentioned in that story?
Oh, yes. Frenchie was present in that story. He was also a member of Bushman's mercenary group at the same time that Mark was. In fact, Frenchie was the one who convinced Mark to turn against Bushman and desert Bushman's organization. And I think he also helps escape after the fight with Mark, escape after the fight with Bushman, if I remember it right. Now, one thing that Mensch keeps close to the vest is whether or not Mark really came back from the dead. For a long time, the question is left ambiguous, with nobody being sure if Khonshu resurrected him or not. It could have been that Mark was just clinically dead for a moment and he was revived, you know, just in time. Mensch doesn't really deal with a lot of heavy mysticism when it comes to Mark's backstory, and he leaves it to the reader to determine what actually happened. Of course, later stories end up leaning heavily into the Khonshu interpretation, and now I don't think there's much room for doubt that Mark truly was brought back from the dead by Khonshu. But I have to confess that I do miss the ambiguity of it, just because sometimes you get some really cool mystery from not knowing certain details. But when you get stories when Mark is clearly possessed by Khonshu, as he was in West Coast Avengers, well, beating around the bush seems kind of pointless after that.
You know, I can certainly see that. There's been a similar complaint about like villains in movies. You know, once you really reveal all their backstory and who they are, it takes something away from them. You got to have a little of that mystery in there to some degree. I totally get what you're saying there. I do have a question, though. I understand that Moon Knight had varying levels of superpowers, like strength and some amount of invulnerability, or at least like a resistance to damage based upon the phases of the moon, at least in the early days. Was this something that was happening back then, or did that come in later?
I believe that started, or was at least implied, during the Mensch run. It was never outright stated in those stories, but it was mentioned as one of his abilities in the official handbook of the Marvel Universe. It was all very low level, though. I mean, think like Cap level or so. The other thing that Mensch did, and this is where I think the Batman comparisons come into play, is the development of Moon Knight's status quo and supporting cast. Mensch decided that Mark would need money to operate, since he would need to be able to afford weapons, vehicles, and so forth, everything else that he uses. In his mind, the best way to do this was to set up an identity as a financier, using his blood money as a mercenary to finance his crusade as Moon Knight. This is where the Stephen Grant identity comes from. In practice, Stephen Grant is basically Moon Knight's answer to Bruce Wayne. Grant is also the person that Mark is trying to become, and a convenient identity to shove aside his crushing guilt for his past as a merc. However, one other interesting feature about Moon Knight at this point in time is that he doesn't work alone. In fact, he relies on a network of people to help him gather information and deal with his enemies. I suspect Mensch may very well have been borrowing a little bit from the Shadow, who also had a network of agents that he relied on. It was likely meant to separate Moon Knight from Batman, who at that time was mainly a lone wolf. Moon Knight's network starts with Frenchie, an old friend from Mark's mercenary days who becomes his pilot and his aide-de-camp. There's also Maureen Allwrong, who we discussed, the daughter of the archaeologist that Bushman killed, who becomes Mark's girlfriend and partner in his adventures. I will say that Maureen is awesome in these stories. She does a lot of Mark's spying and investigative work, and she's even a half-decent fighter when she has to be. However, Maureen really loves the Stephen Grant persona, and she's always trying to encourage Mark to do the right thing. I love the relationship between Mark and Maureen, and I think it's her influence that keeps Mark relatively stable for a good long while. Maureen and Frenchie end up being Mark's supporting cast for quite a long time, actually. Beyond that, there is a writer network that Moon Knight relies on as well. This includes Samuels, who is Stephen Grant's butler. Mark also relies on a number of informants in his identity as Jake Locksley, a cab driver who gets information on what's going on in the underworld. One of Jake's usual haunts is Gina's Diner, where he has a group of friends that feed him information. The owner, Gina, is a longtime friend of Mark's, and so are her two kids. But probably the most interesting patron at Gina's is Bertrand Crawley, a down-on-his-luck recovering alcoholic who tries to put on upper-class airs. Crawley is a really entertaining character who provides a bit of a tension break from the serious drama that goes on in the book. All of them learn who Moon Knight is eventually, becoming willing partners in his mission. All in all, it's not a bad supporting cast while it lasts, though they only last as long as Mensch does.
I actually have another question. You know, I read that there was a time when Mark was just considered insane and had been his whole life. I mean, you talk about his crushing guilt he had over his past and how Grant was a means of shoving that guilt aside. And that is really how DID starts. Other personalities are born out of a defense mechanism in the mind when it cannot handle what is happening. Well, this is pure speculation. I'm guessing there might have been some amount of trauma from his death experience. I have heard several stories about people totally changing after being brought back from the dead. Was there any hint of that back then, that that maybe Grant and Lockley were more than just secret identities?
That's a good question. And honestly, I think you raise a pretty good point about the near-death experience. That does change people. Anyway, the time you're talking about is a retcon that I think is first referenced during the Lemire run, where he tries to establish that the DID started with the death of Mark's brother. I never felt like that was a necessary retcon or that it made a huge amount of sense. I can't imagine that if he was insane the entire time, Mark would have passed the psych evaluations that would have been needed to serve in the military or in the CIA. My view always was that the DID started as a defense mechanism that Mark used to bury his sins. And then Mark buried himself in those identities to not have to deal with the guilt. Later, it evolved into full-blown DID, especially after he lost the influence of people like Barlene, who helped him stay sane.
You know, you make a good point about Mark not being able to pass those psych evaluations. I hadn't really considered that. You're also correct that it was the Lemire run that I got that from. I guess I was just hoping that maybe there were at least some, I don't know, some early seeds planted or something. But let's get on to the bad guys in the series, Steve.
No, there weren't any seeds as far as I can recall. But anyway, yes, let's do that. From here, I want to briefly talk about Moon Knight's villains, because probably most people don't know them. But he actually has a fairly decent rogues gallery, even if they don't tend to get much play outside of their battles with Mark. We've already talked a little bit about Bushman, who is Mark's archenemy for a good part of the run. But I will say that Bushman is an excellent villain for Mark because he embodies everything that Mark is trying to escape. Bushman is a mercenary with no morals or conscience who believes in conquering his enemies with fear. Mark ends up picking the fear motif from Bushman, but he rejects the ruthlessness. And for a while, he even tries not to kill people. They also have that strong personal antagonism because Mark betrayed Bushman, which Bushman has never forgiven him for.
You know, I have to wonder what actually caused this moral epiphany in Mark Spector. I mean, what exactly did Frenchie tell him? Why did he turn on his friend and suddenly gain a conscience when Bushman did that? I have no doubt that similar things has happened in his presence before. I mean, why then? Did they elaborate on that? I'm trying to get a grip on how Bushman sees the situation.
You know, there nearly needs to be a Moon Knight Year One type of book that answers that. Because I don't think that it was ever explored too deeply, at least not during the bench run. It might be that other writers have touched on that, but if they have, I'm not aware of the details. I do know that Mark always had quibbles about Bushman's methods. And as Bushman got worse and worse, Mark got more and more disaffected by what he'd seen. I think Mark probably was willing to excuse a certain amount of ruthlessness, mainly against valid military targets, but he may have underestimated how evil Bushman really was until he killed Dr. Alron. Mark was against the idea of killing civilians just to steal from them, and that was the thing that really kind of pushed him over the edge. But let's get into his other villains. There's the Midnight Man, who doesn't really get interesting until Mark's second battle with him. He kind of starts off as a classy upper-class thief who's driven by greed, but then Midnight nearly dies and is disfigured as a result of his fight with Moon Knight, and then being shot by rubber bullets by Marlene. And I have to say, that was an awesome moment for her. This ends up twisting him mentally, and he now has this very twisted idea of collecting and possessing things. He ends up working with Bushman to get revenge on Mark, which messes Mark up for a while, but eventually Moon Knight gets better and defeats them. It is a really good arc.
I'm curious, why did he go with the name Midnight Man? That really kind of screams split personality to me. Is that what the thing that was going on there?
No, it was just an alias to cover his real identity, where it was an upper-class collector man named Movadark. I think probably the idea was they wanted to go with a dark villain to contrast Moon Knight, who was wearing all in white. Anyway, he didn't want his crime spree to damage his reputation, so Movadark kept his identity secret. Even when he completely lost it, he didn't seem to have DID or anything like that. But there is a villain who does fit that description a little bit better, so we'll talk a bit about him. From here, I'll get into Morpheus. Now, this is no relation to Sandman's Morpheus. In fact, this version predates Sandman by several years. But I love Morpheus because he's one of the creepiest bad guys that Moon Knight goes up against. It turns out that Marlene's brother was a psychologist doing experiments on sleep. This turns one of his patients, Robert Markham, into a monster named Morpheus, as the experiment gives him powers and drives him insane and makes him look a lot more vampiric. Morpheus has low-level dark force powers in exchange for being unable to properly sleep, and he becomes essentially a serial killer. I think you might like the Morpheus stories, Mike, since they have a bit of a Halloween vibe. Peter Allron is treated like a Dr. Loomis character in these stories, with Morpheus in the role of Michael Myers.
Well, I mean, I like a good Michael Myers vibe in a character. I also like the sound of a dream serial killer. I'm reminded of 1984's Dreamscape, where experiments were being done in an academic institution that involved psychics being able to enter into someone's subconscious during REM sleep and manipulate their dreams. One of these psychics, named Blair, learns how to kill a person when he links with them. And as a government agent, he plans on using this skill for assassinations. So not exactly the same, but pretty close, it sounds like. And I like that. I'll have to see if I can track that story down.
You should, as it's definitely worth the look. I should also check out Dreamscape, which I regret I haven't really seen, but it sounds in line with what Morpheus does, at least. But let's move on. Stained Glass Scarlet is another interesting antagonist because she's kind of sympathetic and has a valid point of view, at least from her perspective. Scarlet Fascinera used to be a nun and an actress, but she ends up waging a one-woman war on the mob. She's driven by revenge for the corruption and death of her son. Scarlet had to kill her son because he had gotten involved with drugs and turned murderous because he fell deeper into crime and drugs. She blamed the mob for corrupting her son in the first place, and she decides to use a crossbow as a weapon, feeling it more personal than relying on guns. Mark is kind of torn because at this point he's trying to keep from going over the edge himself, so he knows where Scarlet is coming from. At the same time, he doesn't want to cross over that line at this point. As always, it's Marlene who keeps him balanced and focused when dealing with Scarlet. She's a cool character who puts Mark in some tough moral positions.
You know, I hate to be a jerk here, but I do not understand her perspective at all. It would be one thing if the mob had, like, kidnapped her son and forced drugs on him as a means of controlling him, like what is done in sex trafficking. But her son made those choices on his own. Is it sad and terrible? Absolutely. But you can't blame a drug dealer because people buy drugs off of them. You can't blame a drug dealer because people get strung out and addicted and turn into criminals to get their next fix. Her son knowingly and of his own volition made those choices. What she is talking about sounds more like a parent remembering the innocence of her child as a baby and blaming the world for how he turned out, which conveniently alleviates any responsibility she might have for how she raised him, I might add. But that is just my two cents with some interest, I might add. But I believe you had one more villain you wanted to discuss, didn't you, Steve?
Yeah, that's a totally a fair counterpoint. I think Scarlet is consumed with pain and rage, and she just was looking for somewhere to channel it, even if it wasn't in a productive direction. But yes, let's move on. The last major villain I want to talk about is Carson Knowles, the Black Spectre. Knowles is a politically connected son of a politician, but he goes to war, loses his father, and then his life crumbles around him. He learns to hate the city for its mistreatment of him, and then he embarks on a scheme to run for mayor to get his revenge on the city. So he takes Moon Knight as an inspiration to rebuild his life, framing himself as Moon Knight's opposite. He's a twisted dude, and he very nearly wins, getting some victories on Mark, including beating Frenchie so bad that he had to be hospitalized. And he very even nearly succeeds in turning Marlene against Mark. He only appears in that last issue of the Sienkiewicz run, but Black Spectre's a memorable villain, and he ends up taking the spot of arch-villain after that. Also, I'll leave you with this last gem about Black Spectre. It's a clever name for an evil version of Moon Knight. He's a dark version of Mark Spector, and he calls himself Black Spector. Knowing Mark Minch, I have to think that was intentional.
You know, Black Spectre almost kind of, I don't know, it has an eclipse kind of thing to it.
Mm-hmm.
But, oh my God, Mark has a furious sense of vengeance. And I'm imagining that after hospitalizing Duchamp and even coming close to getting Marlene to turn on him, Mark must have been raging like Bjorn. So tell me, how was that final fight? Did Mark lose it or what?
He did at first, I'm not going to lie. I mean, Mark gets close to the edge, but when he did, he played into Black Spectre's hands by making public accusations that he couldn't back up with evidence. So by the end, Mark ends up learning his lessons and plays it smarter. He gets into a nasty fight with Black Spectre, but it's a trap. Even though Knowles gets the upper hand in the fight, he ends up exposing himself as the villain. Mark ends up making a brave stand, and he refuses to give up his integrity and self-respect, making him look better. It helped that Marlene did it as her own digging into Knowles and found proof of his criminal behavior. With Knowles exposed, he's defeated in the court of public opinion, and his run for mayor is shut down. Another big reason for the success of this run is the art of Bill Sienkiewicz, who undergoes a huge artistic transformation on Moon Knight. He starts off being very heavily influenced by Neil Adams, which in fairness is a great fit for a book like this. If you want to do Marvel's Batman, then getting your own Neil Adams makes perfect sense to me. But as the run goes on, Sienkiewicz becomes more experimental with the book, and this is where he establishes his signature style as the book looks weirder and weirder with each issue. Mensch gives him plenty of material to do this with as well, especially when he gets into Mark's headscape from time to time. Mark's encounters with Morpheus, especially his second battle with him, takes on more of a horror vibe as Sienkiewicz creates some nightmarish dream sequences, and I have to say that Sienkiewicz makes him look kind of like Hal Orlock, which is great. Also, Morpheus himself is at his creepiest whenever he's drawn by Sienkiewicz. This is considered the definitive run on Moon Knight, and it's the run that later writers usually turn to as their inspiration. Mensch built the foundation for what this series is, and Sienkiewicz brings it to life in this surreal and beautiful way. The interesting thing is, each of these stories is usually a single issue, or at most maybe two, when there's something really big going down in the book. The level of economy in this series is really impressive, I have to say. This is a must read if you're interested in learning more about Mark Spector, in my view.
Wow, that does sound pretty awesome. I will have to see if I can track down those issues in a trade or something. But for now, I would like to jump into Moon Knight's fifth volume of comics, launched in April 2006 and written by Charlie Houston with art by David Finch. Houston updated the character by putting Mark Spector's military service during the Gulf War. But Houston did not stay on as writer for the whole volume. While Houston stayed on as a story and plot advisor, Mike Benson actually took over writing the title at issue 14. The volume only ran for 30 issues, though, and with one annual, and Peter Milligan wrote a 2008 seasonal one-shot titled Moon Knight, Silent Night with artist Lawrence Campbell. The story does not start out in a very clear place, really. I'm guessing I had to read Volume 4 to understand everything. Unfortunately, Volume 4 is not on Comixology Unlimited. What I can tell you is that this run has a very different tone, and Mark Spector is clearly on the ragged edge of sanity here. He is not just more violent, but he is enjoying it. He refers to brutally fighting crime as the fun stuff. He has quite the battle with Raoul Bushman on a rooftop that causes both men to fall several stories into an alley below. And on the way down, Moon Knight busts up his kneecaps really bad on the railing as he falls. We're talking exposed bone here. As the fight is going on, Mark contemplates the futility of fighting the same men over and over again, only to end up back where he is now. How much will finally be enough for Khonshu? Well, with years and years of pent-up rage and frustration over constantly fighting the same men, Moon Knight cuts off Bushman's face and holds it up into the air, asking Khonshu if this is finally enough. Afterwards, Spectre is then haunted by Khonshu, who has chosen the now faceless Bushman as his representative. Mark meets up with Frenchie, who reveals that he is gay, or at least bi, and that the reason he has stayed by Mark's side all these years is because he's in love with Mark. But at the same time, he knows that these feelings can never be reciprocated. Mark also attempts to make amends with Marlene, and it seems that he is able to patch things together, at least somewhat.
I'd say that Frenchie's more bi than anything, but they do play up his relationships with men in later runs. But he did have one very meaningful relationship with this French woman that ended it because of the secrets that she had kept, and those secrets left to her death. That was in a Mensch Sienkiewicz issue. But my feeling is that Frenchie probably had many affairs with both men and women, and he just doesn't really care as long as the other person matters to him. It makes sense that Frenchie would stay by Mark for that reason, but eventually we see that Mark will even drive him away with how far off the rails he gets. Now, I admit that I have not read much of Houston's run, though I have the first issue that I got on Comixology for free. First, I'll say that Dave Finch's art on the book is awesome. It's phenomenal. But yes, Mark does get much more brutal in that issue, I have to agree. He does steadily fall off the wagon after Marlene is out of his life, getting closer to the edge. Eventually, we do see Moon Knight become a full-blown killer, embracing the darkness he was trying to hold back during the Mensch run. I think I'm getting ahead of myself on that, though. But I think you had more to add on, Houston, Mike?
I do, Steve. A lot more, in fact. The committee returns, this time as the Secret Committee. And they have hired someone named the Profile with superhuman level analytical skills and believes that he can predict within something like 95% accuracy how a person will respond in a given situation. The Secret Committee has hired him for but one purpose, to take out Moon Knight. But the plan fails miserably, and in a twist turn, Profile actually ends up being a reluctant confidant and informant for Mark Spector. Meanwhile, Moon Knight's reputation for brutality and ruthlessness lead to Spider-Man trying to talk to him and see if he can get Mark to ease off the pedal a little bit. In a strange turn of events, Mark Spector actually replaces one of his alters with versions of Spider-Man immediately after talking to him. Meanwhile, a serial killer began killing people and using the blood from their bodies to form a clock that was pointing to midnight. Obviously, Moon Knight's first assumption was that it had to be his old foe, Anton Mogart, aka Midnight Man, somehow back from the dead after Moon Knight had killed him. But things would be worse than he thought. Jeff Wilde, the son of Midnight Man, had been trained by his father before he died and had taken up the mantle of Midnight. Now, Moon Knight was not oblivious to this, but he had hoped that he could turn Jeff from his father's path by taking him on as a partner. What Moon Knight did not know was the Midnight Killer, as it were, was Jeff Wilde himself, stronger than ever and out on a mission of revenge against Moon Knight for his father's death. Jeff Wilde attacks Mark at home and left him in a pool of blood before saying he wanted the entire Moon Knight experience. But their battle was not done, and soon they had ventured into the sewers. But again, Midnight took the upper hand and pinned Midnight to a clock. Midnight found himself betrayed at this point by Lynn, who struck him. Moon Knight then freed himself, and no longer seeking any kind of reconciliation, Moon Knight killed him by stabbing him in the head with the clock hand.
Firstly, ouch. That sounds nasty. Now, I actually do remember Jeff Wilde from a Spider-Man arc called Round Robin from back during the Dave Michelinie run. He became a cyborg at one point, and then he had completely lost it. I do recall that Moon Knight was trying to save him and that he had tried to take him as a partner at one point. So it is a bit surprising that Mark would give up on him and just straight up murder Jeff like that. And from what you described, it does seem like it was Houston who started Moon Knight on this much more hardcore path that he finally took. But you had more you wanted to bring up, Mike?
There is a lot more to this run. But unfortunately, I did not get the chance to read it all. But I think you can get a clear taste of what this volume is like. I can tell you that the art and colors are amazing, as Steve said, and that I really enjoy the extremely dark take on Moon Knight. But I believe you actually wanted to go into Volume 7, am I right, Steve?
Why, yes, I do. Many writers since have tried to repeat the success of Doug mentioned Bill Sienkiewicz. They had varying degrees of success, but it never worked out as well as that run did it. Various writers had attempted to reinvent Moon Knight in the years since, but I don't think Marvel quite hit on the right formula until Warren Ellis took over the series. Where I think Ellis got it right is that he respected the Mensch Sienkiewicz run while trying not to duplicate what they did. There are some elements where Ellis clearly models on them. The single issue storylines dealing with the darkness in New York City, the crazy psychodramas that get in the head of Mark Spector and playing up Mark as an unreliable narrator. Structurally, Ellis draws very noticeably on Mensch, and both runs even end with a battle with Black Spector, though Ellis does his own version of the character. But Ellis adds new elements to the tapestry, especially the voice of Khonshu and the source of his madness. Most importantly, he adds a new persona to the already complex list of Malters, the character of Mr. Knight. Now, in the comics, Mr. Knight is awesome. This persona is a police consultant who dresses in fancy white suits and wears a white mask. He tends to be a somewhat more approachable than Moon Knight is, but when Mr. Knight rolls up the sleeves and gets dirty, he is every bit as dangerous and then some. There's a really awesome issue where Mr. Knight has to climb up a building through levels of goons to save a young girl, a game of death style. There's some real rough and visceral violence in the issue. And as Mr. Knight breaks a truncheon in a guy's face, it's great.
That was awesome. Actually, I really liked that issue too. Those were some brutal fights. And you know I like that. I hadn't thought about it until just now, but it was very game of death, with things getting more severe with each level that Mr. Knight went up on. I have to agree that Mr. Knight is awesome. One of my favorite aspects of Spectre, actually. But if I may comment on the whole black and white color palette from Moon Knight and its various alters, The idea harkens back to Don Perlin's black and white concept. He wanted Moon Knight to stand out against the color backgrounds, and he certainly does. It is not a wonder that they make a point about that and reveal that Mr. Knight actually wants his enemies to see him coming. He wants them afraid.
Yes, and very true. And it's something that I noticed that Houston brought up in the one issue that I read of his run. So it's a nice callback that Ellis brought up, though I'm not 100% sure if he actually read Houston or not. Now, the system of alters is also different in this run. Previously, Mark's identity confusion was the result of his slipping into these different roles and becoming the mask, as it were. My interpretation of this has always been that Mark Spector hates himself because of the crushing weight of his guilt. And so Mark has always done his best to bury his past self. So he embraces these other personas as a way of not dealing with the blood he spilled and escaping his dark past. But Ellis takes a different slant that I found interesting. Still, it's hard to know how true anything is, especially since we see the world through the eyes of a literal lunatic. Did you have any thoughts on how Ellis handled that, Mike?
I do have a couple of thoughts on that. Ellis really set a new stage with some big reveals. A big one was that Mark Spector does not have DID as a result of the stress of multiple cover identities. If that were true, there would be an epidemic of soap opera actors putting bags on their heads and cutting people's faces off. In reality, Mark's symptoms do not really line up with a DID diagnosis, according to Dr. Warsami, his psychiatrist. What they do line up with is brain damage caused by Khonshu altering the structure of Mark Spector's mind. That is particularly interesting because there was doubt about Khonshu's existence on the part of Dr. Ellis Owarsami in the past. But she was willing to admit that Khonshu is an actual outer terrestrial entity that has colonized Mark Spector's brain with its aspect. Mark's mind has simply struggled to define this process, and to do so, it attempted to apply personalities to these aspects, which is a different process than DID. Those same alterations made by Khonshu caused Moon Knight to occasionally shift in personality to match one of Khonshu's four distinct roles as the Moon God. It is why he sometimes has four alters existing simultaneously, but never more than that. These four roles are described as the Pathfinder, Embracer, Defender, and Watcher over of Overnight Travelers. Last but not least, in Mark Spector's more violent moments, Khonshu's vengeful secret aspect, the one who lives on hearts, which is very ominous. These four roles can manifest in different ways, either with original names or borrowing names and personalities and traits of people Mark has observed, like when he took on alternate personalities based on seeing Spider-Man, Wolverine, and Captain America in L.A. The other big confirmation was that Spectre did in fact die and was resurrected years ago in the tomb in Egypt, putting an end to the ambiguity.
Yeah, I figured that had to be the case, given the sheer number of stories that openly have Khonshu getting involved with Mark's life, possessing his body, or any of a number of different weird things. I think the ambiguity worked for Mensch because he was careful enough not to be too explicit with it, but other writers have openly dealt with God's magic and such to the extent that it seems unlikely that Khonshu didn't raise him from the dead. And it is a shame in a way, because I do like the ambiguity, but that's the way that characters evolve sometimes. And I like what he evolved into. But speaking of Khonshu, Ellis leans into the Egyptian mysticism more than most writers have to date. Moon Knight establishes his role as a protector of travelers by night, which is consistent with his role as the Fist of Khonshu. You also have an issue where Moon Knight has to fight angry ghosts, which he's ill-equipped to deal with until Khonshu reminds him that the Egyptians have weapons against the dead. So Mark goes rummaging through Grant Mansion and finds old Egyptian wrappings that he uses to fight the ghosts. It's way cooler than I make it sound. Mike, did you have any favorite Ellis issues that you wanted to bring up?
Actually, there is, but I will say that I like that issue with the ghosts as well, and Mark's eventual solution for dealing with them. But on to my favorite issue. Surprise, surprise, it's the one called Slasher. I liked the Holmesian detective style of Mr. Knight in the Slasher story of issue number one. You mix those kinds of brains with Mr. Knight's badassery, and you have a pretty fun character to watch. And this issue delivered. I also like Detective Flint's explanation to the young officer about how the cops on the street do not refer to Mr. Knight as Moon Knight because then they would have to take him down by whatever force is necessary. This was actually kind of reminiscent of Batman comics. There was often an older cop who was more familiar with Batman trying to train a youngster on how to act in these situations.
It's good to see Detective Flint again. He's an old ally of Mark's going back to the Mensch run, so it was nice that Ellis remembered him. Of course, the unstated reason for why Flint doesn't interfere with Mark is that he tried it once and it ended badly for him. So it's cool to see that he learned from that encounter, and now he's trying to pass that on to the younger officers with him. But I also really like the whole consulting detective angle with Mr. Knight, and you get some really cool moments as he chases down the slasher. But with that out of the way, I think you wanted to make some points on Khonshu, Mike.
I do. You know I have to talk about mythology if it ever comes up. It's just my jam. Besides, right. You did bring up Egyptian mysticism, and I would like to point out that there are some distinct differences between the Marvel Comics Khonshu and the Egyptian moon god Khonshu, beyond just the spelling. The name Khonshu literally means traveler, and he was named that because the moon, or La in Egyptian, travels across the night. Khonshu from the myth actually had 5 prominent roles, not 4 main roles and a secret one. Khonshu was the embracer, the pathfinder, defender, healer, and he was said to watch over travelers at night. But the Marvel Comics all but switches out the fact that he was a healer for the ultra-violent He Who Lives on Hearts aspect. As the god of light in the night, Khonshu was evoked to protect against wild animals and aid with healing. There are times where Mark Spector genuinely seems to try to help someone get better in terms of personal growth, and I think he did try to help Dr. Warsami, so that healer aspect might be in there somewhere, but it's not exactly a cure wound spell, if you know what I mean. Whereas Khonshu was evoked in healing spells. It was also said that when Khonshu caused the crescent moon to shine, women would conceive, cattle would become fertile, and it caused the nostrils and all the throats in the land to be filled with fresh air. At the Temple of Khonshu at Karnak, one of the walls depicts the creation myth in which Khonshu is the great snake who fertilizes the cosmic egg in the creation of the world. That's a huge deal. It doesn't actually apply to a lot of Egyptian mythology, but it's an interesting little take on that. But a couple of the biggest differences are that Khonshu never had an avatar to act as his fist, and there is no vengeance aspect to Khonshu. But you'll note that a few Marvel Comics characters seem to deal with vengeance specifically, and it would seem that Marvel Knight is lumped into that category. My guess is because of the defender aspect, but that seems to be stretching it a bit, and that is just my opinion.
It is a cool motif for a dark anti-hero like Moon Knight. But yeah, probably the vengeance angle was tacked on, not necessarily a part of the mythology. Granted that this goes back to ancient Egyptian culture, and they would have accepted a certain amount of violence back then to get the job done, much like Mark does. So I'm honestly okay with the idea of Moon Knight as someone who protects travelers at nights and avenges them if necessary. But getting back to Ellis, this is a short run, and it's only 6 issues long. I wish that Ellis and Shalvey had stuck around longer, but Ellis tends to typically do short runs like this before moving on. His attention span is pretty short as a writer. Still, it's 6 really great issues that turn Moon Knight on his head, and you really get you really thinking about Mark Spector in a different way. I'd even argue that the Ellis run on Moon Knight opened the doors for other writers to go even crazier with the character. Mike, did you want to talk about some of those?
I can do that. Brian Wood and Greg Smallwood were the team for issues 7 through 12 of Volume 7 on Moon Knight. Brian Wood's run, while obviously involving Moon Knight and Mr. Knight, has a lot to do with exposing Dr. Warsami for who she really is. In this run, we get introduced to a new body armor suit for Moon Knight, complete with a scarab drones and enhanced strength. He actually crushes a guy's wrist just by squeezing it. But he shifts between the Stephen Grant, Jake Lockley, and Mr. Knight personalities while being Moon Knight. And Lockley in particular seems to be sadistically violent. But when Brian Wood takes over, Moon Knight deals with a blackout across New York caused by an assassin with an EMP sent by Dr. Ellis Warsami to kill General Lore. But before the assassin was knocked out by Moon Knight, Mark learns that the assassin was a soldier and saw firsthand the cruelty and viciousness of General Lore and swore to avenge the murder of General Lore's own people and to rid the world of him because men like General Lore would never truly change and he would always be a warlord. But things really start going crazy around issue number 9, where Wood explores Dr. Warsami by having her tell her story, or rather her fake story, to Mark Spector in what Mark believes is an attempt to recruit him like she had recruited the assassin. But it turns out that she actually had been trying to recruit Khonshu himself with her tale, and it works. Dr. Warsami is temporarily chosen as Khonshu's new avatar to deal with General Lore, and Dr. Warsami, having set a bomb to go off while Mark was in a state of hypnosis, leaves him there to die. Mark Spector awakes to find her gone and her hit list on the computer and a bomb, but seemingly feels empty without Khonshu and his altars, and by all appearances just stands there as the bomb blows up. Dr. Warsami, now as the Fist of Khonshu, uses her powers to procure another assassin to kill General Lore, but this time from the UN building. Out of nowhere, and with no explanation for how he got out of there, and stops her from shooting General Lore, but she is arrested and detained at a mental health facility as a 5150, and all of his assets have been frozen. Whereas Khonshu called Mark Spector his son back in issue number one, he now coldly disregards Mark and tells him he's having a pity party for not liking it. Khonshu simply saw a better prospect and he took it. Meanwhile, one of his fellow inmates tries to kill Mark with a shank on the yard. But Khonshu still meets with him, and Mark eventually convinces Khonshu that he is being used and tries to escape and ends up falling out of an airplane at terminal velocity. And Khonshu relents and once again covers him in Khonshu's clothes to save his life as he falls. But Khonshu warns him that his time is short. Meanwhile, Dr. Warsami is still in her Khonshu form and interrogates General Lore mentally. But it turns out that she doesn't quite have the balls to carry out her mission, if you'll pardon the expression. And Khonshu abandons her and returns to Mark, admitting that he was right. Khonshu admitting that Mark was right is a big deal. Just note that. Meanwhile, General Lore reveals that Warsami's past was a lie and that she was no poor villager like she's been telling everybody. She was the governor's daughter, and it was in fact her and her family that were the brutalizers. Her father looted Akima, the country that she's from, by way of her mineral mines, which led to the downfall of the entire country. All of Dr. Warsami's scheming was about getting the money her father had stolen from the resistance leader who was fighting against her father, General Lore. Moon Knight, of course, stops her, but things end on a pretty sour note with Brian Wood's run.
You know, I have to admit that I never really trusted that psychologist. There was just something about her that fell off to me in the Ellis issues, so having her turn out to be a villain didn't really surprise me at all. Not to mention that I wondered how Dr. Warsami would even know as much as she does about Mark's brain chemistry and Khonshu's effect on it. That didn't seem to me like something that a standard therapist would know how to measure. I mean, even a high-priced one. It is cool that Wood decided to address that question himself, and it seemed like he found a satisfying answer in what seems like a solid story. But I think you had another run you wanted to bring up, Mike?
I sure do, but I will say quickly that I definitely got that Dr. Warsami was a bit off in some way in that first issue as well, though I could not really nail down why I felt that way. But let's get into the next writer on this run. That is, of course, Cullen Bunn and artist Ron Atkins, who took over for issues 13 through 17. Bunn starts off with Mark living in an old rundown hotel in New York that turns out to be infested with ghosts. Mark tries to convince them to leave his new home, but Khonshu tells him that he is Khonshu's priest, and these ghosts, whether he likes them or not, are part of his flock as the shepherd. The priest-shepherd concept would expand to include abused dogs, so vicious that their attacks were mistaken as coming from a werewolf. But in this particular mission, it would seem that both Khonshu and Wepowet, a humanoid wolf deity and the son of Anumis, are calling in a favor to get it dealt with, which is weird, and they don't actually address that again later. But granted, Mr. Knight does have to fight the dogs when a pack of them attack him, but there is restraint in his actions. But after learning the coldness and cruelty of the owner who trained the dogs to attack the rich specifically by the clothes and items they carried, the picture becomes clear. So it was very appropriate that Moon Knight simply turned the dogs against their master and they ate him alive. But no sooner does Moon Knight do said favor for Khonshu and Wepowet than Khonshu once again abandons Mark when he tries to fight a monster that kills children, simply called the Boogeyman. His reason? Khonshu did not sanction this attack on the Boogeyman, so Mark tells Khonshu that he doesn't need him anymore. Then Mark resorts to his mercenary tactics, using guns, and goes after the Boogeyman again, only to find out that the Boogeyman was in fact a servant of Khonshu, who was also asking why Khonshu had betrayed him. The issue ends with Mark with just this shocked look on his face. The next issue, without explanation, we see Mark back in the Moon Knight getup and defending the city again, and there is no mention of Khonshu's betrayal. But the run wraps up with Khonshu somehow being taken by a servant of another god and used for their own ends. But Mark knows that what this cult is doing is not the way of Khonshu. And he stands against the Avatar. With Khonshu's guidance, he takes them down. Afterwards, it would seem that Khonshu and Mark are one again. But if you ask me, Khonshu has earned a not-to-be-trusted ranking.
Khonshu has more than earned that ranking, and as we see, it gets even worse. As for Bun, that's a run I haven't read, so I can't really talk that much about it. But it does make sense that Khonshu is playing more of his games with this story. I have a feeling that Bun was trying to bridge the Ellis run with what comes next with Lemire, and it seems like he was able to manage that. So let's move on to our next run. One of the most influential writers on Moon Knight in recent years is Jeff Lemire. You can definitely see his mark on the Moon Knight show, particularly towards the end of the series. The reason for this is that Lemire goes over the top bonkers on Moon Knight, dropping Mark in weird situation and going even crazier with it. The initial setup is that Mark Spector wakes up one day in a mental hospital. He gets beaten up and tortured by the guards, and the doctor is trying to gaslight him into thinking he's made up all of his other personas, including Moon Knight, that he was never Moon Knight at all. The other inmates of the prison include many of Mark's former allies, including Gina, Crawley, and even Marlene. So because Mark is an unreliable narrator, you're left wondering whether he's making some of this craziness up or if someone has done something to him and kidnapped his friends. This turns into a weird They Live situation where Mark puts on an improvised cloak at the direction of presumably Khonshu. When he puts on the cloak, he sees the guards as jackal-headed beings, and Khonshu tells Mark that this is the doing of the Egyptian god Seth. As an aside, Seth in the Marvel Universe is the Egyptian god and brother of Osiris, while Set is an elder god and connected to the Conan mythos. But getting back to this, later on, Mark loses the cloak and he's back in the hospital situation with normal seeming guards. Mark is brought to the doctor, who turns out to be an avatar of Amut, the goddess of judgment. Note that in Egyptian belief, Amut is known as the devourer of the dead, who swallows up the souls that may fail to measure up to the standards of Maat, or truth. So she's sitting in judgment of Mark's soul as he goes through this bizarre asylum. Mark is given more electroshock therapy, and he falls unconscious where he meets with Khonshu in a place called the Other Void. Khonshu informs him of various things, a few of which are retcons. Basically, the gods of Heliopolis inhabit the Other Void, but they have limited influence on the mortal world. Khonshu tells Mark that Seth has found a tear in the fabric of reality that has allowed him to pass through, and Khonshu wants Mark to stop him. This tear is what's allowing the gods to have more influence on the human world. Khonshu also reveals that he chose Mark because he has a weak mind, allowing Khonshu to more easily reach him and use him for his purposes. The problem is that now the other gods are able to take advantage of this, which is why things seem to make little sense. The other gods are feeding Mark with lies and delusions, clouding his judgment and gaslighting him to believe he's in a false reality. Eventually, Mark is able to stage an escape with the help of his trapped friends, taking on the Mr. Knight persona again. You get cool fights with an ancient Egyptian mummies, and then things get even weirder as Lemire drops more surprises. I don't want to spoil the entire run for you, as it's a good 3 arcs long and it's pretty complicated, but I think that the description gives a good taste of the kind of crazy things that Lemire was doing with Mark Spector. This run leans very heavily into the psychodrama and the craziness, and it does a good job of making you question absolutely everything you see. Is Mark really delusional, and has he made up his entire career as Moon Knight, or are the gods real and messing with his head? You never really know, and that's what's so great about it. Lemire brought that sense of ambiguity back that was largely missing since the Mensch days, while also taking the Egyptian mysticism up to 11. The gods in this run are almost Lovecraftian in nature, a thing that Ellis hinted at and Lemire goes full speed with. You also get some interesting changes with Mark's relationship with Khonshu, and later on there are some interesting revelations. While there's some elements that I question, the Lemire run is largely really good, and it's easy to see why it had such an impact.
Actually, I would like to talk a bit about Khonshu and his involvement with Mark Spector as revealed in that Lemire run. Khonshu has made a psychic connection with Mark Spector when he was a young boy after the death of his younger brother, as you said. And it was indicated that it was responsible for Mark's DID-like condition and assuming alter identity of Stephen Grant when he was a young boy, too. Khonshu then influenced and guided Mark over the decades and waited until just the right moment to reveal himself and take over Mark's body. I'm having a hard time seeing Khonshu in the Marvel Universe as anything more than patiently wicked and untrustworthy.
Oh, yes. Lemire definitely paints Khonshu as a pretty awful dude. I'm not sure I like the idea of Khonshu having manipulated Mark for his entire life, but I absolutely can buy Khonshu being pretty manipulative and kind of an asshole. This really is another reason why you can't trust much from Mark's perspective, because you don't know how much of it is being fed to him by Khonshu. I also feel bad for Mark because his mind has been torn apart because of the whims of a petty and capricious god. But I think you wanted to get into the most recent series, Mike.
I do, but I too feel pretty bad for Mark. His story is a tragedy without a doubt. But as you say, let's talk about the last run we're going to cover today. And that is Volume 9, which launched in 2021 with writer Jed McKay and artist Alessandro Capuccio and Rachel Rosenberg. Some things have changed since the age of Khonshu. It is suggested that Mark might be essentially immortal as he keeps coming back to life. But a big change is that Khonshu is actually imprisoned after being defeated by the Avengers. But Mark is not only back to crime fighting, he has adopted the role of the High Priest of Khonshu and set up what he calls the Midnight Mission and assumes a neighborhood marked by his white moon and as his congregation, as well as the Travelers of the Night. The marking is said to be a warning against those who would harm his people and a symbol of hope to his people that they will be protected. He embraces the aspect of Khonshu as the traveler, the pathfinder, the embracer, and the defender of the travelers at night.
That does sound like a cool setup for Moon Knight. It is a logical next step based on what's been set up since the Warren Ellis run. I keep hearing that Jed McKay has done some really good stuff on this book, but I still unfortunately haven't gotten around to it. I probably should pick up the trades the next time they're on a Comixology sale. But I think you had more details you wanted to get into.
I do, but I mean, I just want to tell you, I would personally recommend that run myself. I really enjoyed this particular portrayal. It felt like some kind of balance was achieved, but there was one part of the story that really stuck with me, and that was Mark's reason for embracing Khonshu. While he was raised in a Jewish household, Mark never really experienced that connection with God the way that others seem to have done, at least not until Khonshu. With Khonshu, Mark at last felt that divine communion. So even though he no longer feels that Khonshu is a god worthy of his worship, Mark Spector still considers himself to be spiritually connected to the deity. And that is why he is willing to continue on as Moon Knight and why he chose to be Khonshu's high priest. As the high priest, Mark takes up the suit and mask of Mr. Knight persona as his holy vestments. In his role as the embracer, Mark decides to spare a group of young vampires because they were forced into a situation and were for all intents and purposes innocent. One of these young vampires named Reese even takes up a job at the Midnight Mission as Mark's assistant.
One point, important point that I regret that we've neglected up to this point is that Mark Spector is a Jewish character. Some runs have dealt with it, including Jeff Lemire's, but it sounds like Jim McKay has set up a good reason for why Mark has abandoned Judaism and turned to Khonshu instead. It may be that Mark feels that he's so stained with guilt that he no longer feels that he's worthy of God's love, which is a pretty bleak place for him to be in. So he turns to Khonshu instead. Though with Khonshu, I feel like Mark is almost in an abusive relationship. As we see, he benefits from being Moon Knight in some ways, such as coming back from the dead numerous times, but the cost is that Khonshu is a manipulative and demanding god to work for. Khonshu has probably made a mess of Mark's life as well, destroying his sanity and any hope that he has for living a normal life ever again. But things get more complicated for Mark, it sounds like.
Things get much more complicated, Steve, but I want to address the thing with Mark, Judaism, and Khonshu. You say that you consider it a possibility that Mark felt unworthy of God's love and that leading him to a dark place. And there is actually some indication of that in the comics. However, and this is just my take after reading it, I got the impression his feeling of unworthiness was an attempt at coming up with the reason why God might have rejected him. Not to mention that he is referring to a time when he had not left home yet and had not done all of the terrible things that he would do. But as far as abandoning God and Judaism, Mark does go into that a bit in that same conversation. He says that his father was adamantly nonviolent and that Mark thought he was weak for being that way when he was younger. When you combine that with Mark's father being a rabbi, then you can see how a perception of his father being weak led to a similar view of God and Judaism as a part of the reason why he abandoned it. I know that my view of my father when I was younger led me to hate his God. So maybe I'm projecting here. But at the same time, Mark had grown to understand that his father was not weak at all, and he could see the strength his father possessed and in turn the value of his piety. again, I may be projecting, but I too have come to have a better understanding of God and saw my father in a different light, and it made me a more spiritual person. I see that same thing going on here with Mark assuming the role of the high priest of Khonshu and starting the Midnight Mission. But what do you think about that, Steve? Am I putting too much of myself into that story?
It's hard to say for sure, but I do understand why you feel that way. I mean, we do understand that Mark distanced himself from his family in part because his mother blamed him for the death of his brother. So it's not implausible that Mark made the choice not to be his father, rejecting his father's way and joining the military. It's also not implausible that the reaction included rejecting his father's faith. There could be other reasons as well, of course, but it's an interpretation that makes sense with Mark's character in history, so I can't rule it out. But why don't we move on?
That sounds like a great idea. In this run, we find out that Mark may be the left fist of Khonshu, but there is another fist, the right fist, and he is Dr. Batter, MD, aka Hunter's Moon. Hunter's Moon seeks to test and correct Moon Knight, who he believes has strayed from Khonshu's ways, particularly as it pertains to letting vampires exist in his neighborhood. Hunter's Moon explains that vampires have always attacked and hunted at night, and by definition, they have always been the mortal enemies of Khonshu and the fists of Khonshu. The two of them have quite a battle, and during that fight, it is revealed that Hunter's Moon received what amounts to a spiritual download of the memories of all the previous fists of Khonshu, and therefore, he has lifetimes of combat training that makes him a more elegant and graceful fighter. What's more is that Hunter Moon wins that initial fight and then goes after the vampires to clear Moon Knight's life of the distractions keeping him from Khonshu's path. But this fight ain't over, and Moon Knight shows up with a baseball bat and beats the living shit out of Hunter's Moon, saving the vampires. But in an odd turn of events, when Moon Knight is being severely beaten by Zodiac later, Reese goes to Hunter's Moon for help, which was pretty dangerous considering she is one of the vampires he hates. And Hunter's Moon comes and saves Moon Knight and even provides medical treatment. When it's over, Mark asks why Hunter's Moon helped him. And Hunter's Moon explains that while he may not like or respect Moon Knight, they do have the same father, Khonshu, and that makes them brothers.
Wow, that really sounds cool. I mean, it sounds like an awesome story, and I'm beginning to see why Jed MacKay has earned the respect that he has on Moon Knight. Hunter's Moon sounds like a cool addition to Moon Knight's rogues gallery, and I really like the idea of pitting them against each other on differences in religious doctrine. It sounds like the action is really well handled as well. Baseball bat, awesome. I really am going to have to finally pick this run up because it sounds like this book really gets what Moon Knight is about.
Oh, it definitely does, my friend. This was an awesome run, and it made me think more than any of the other Moon Knight comics I read on a philosophical level, and I love that. Plus, it's awesome to get to tell you about a comic for a change. But before we wrap up, I wanted to give some closing thoughts. I feel like I just got a giant crash course on Moon Knight. Believe it or not, folks, I didn't know any of this just a couple of weeks ago. But I devoured all the comics I could find on Comixology Unlimited over the last couple of weeks, and my friend Steve here filled in all the rest. All I had ever seen before this was the series on Disney Plus, but I have grown to really like Moon Knight as a character and appreciate the complexities of the series. All in all, I have had a blast, and I cannot wait until next week.
Likewise, I know a lot of the major points when it comes to Moon Knight, but there's still a lot I haven't covered in my own reading, as we've discussed. So between the two of us, I hope we've given a comprehensive look at the character as presented in the books. For now, that wraps up our general coverage of the Moon Knight comics. As we've hopefully shown, Mark Spector is a fascinating character with some deep layers, and he is far from Marvel's Batman. I know I'm curious about the runs I haven't read, and I hope you'll check out all of our recommendations if you want to learn more about Moon Knight. Next time, we'll get into part two of our Moon Knight two-parter, where we'll talk about how Mark Spector has been adapted on screen. Until then, we thank you all for listening, and thanks to all of our patrons who make this podcast possible.
I hope you've had fun hanging out with us today on ORP. I know that Steve and I have had fun making this episode. If you've had fun too, we invite you to share this episode and help us get the word out.
For our Spotify listeners, we ask you to please rate our show as well. That can really help to grow our audience. But to all our listeners everywhere, we want to say thank you for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.